Welcome to Faith in the Folds, a podcast for ministry, biblical studies, and Christian living. I'm your host, Kevin Burr. Joining me on the show today is Dr. Benjamin Shaw, president of Core Apologetics and adjunct professor for Liberty University and Colorado Christian University. Ben has several publications to his name, which are linked in the description below, and of particular interest to this audience is his upcoming work published with InterVarsity Press called Trustworthy, 13 Arguments for the Reliability of the New Testament, coming out July 30th of this year, available for pre-order now from IVP and Amazon. Ben, it is a pleasure to have you on the show today. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, Kevin. Thanks so much for having me. Excited to be here. We've been friends for a while, and I've always enjoyed your work. I was glad Mike Lacona was the one that introduced us.
Yeah, I did that. One of my, as you might be able to tell for those watching, I'm here at church in my studio, and I was telling our youth minister about who I was interviewing, and I was trying to remember how exactly we got to know each other. I think I might have even described us as internet friends because we haven't met in person, but we've been aware of each other's work for a little bit. And so, was it Mike who introduced our work to each other?
So I did a half a chapter in my dissertation on the criteria. Kevin has done a whole book on it. So I was very thankful Kevin did, because to me that criteria just seem quite obvious as just natural tools we would use to know the past. And I did a great job of unpacking the criteria and how people who are somewhat skeptical of the criteria actually use the criteria themselves. Yeah. And it's because it's a normal, natural process to use these different criteria to understand what has likely occurred in the past. So just good stuff.
Yeah. For those who are wondering what on earth has been talking about, I'll be happy to go into more detail about that probably in another episode. So just keep staying tuned to Faith in the Folds, and I'll eventually get to that. I'm not going to give anything away too much now, but Lacona has a book coming out in April of 2024. And he's agreed to let me interview him on that. And so we might get to do a little bit more with him later. So, Ben, tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got to Liberty, what you're doing these days. Help us get to know you a little bit before we kind of jump into all the interesting things that you're up to.
Yeah. So I'll give you a little bit about my background before I came to Liberty, because Liberty was not my first school, or my second, or my third, or my fourth.
Same pattern here.
Yeah, fifth school I went to. So I'm originally from South Florida, Fort Lauderdale area. And I grew up, my babysitter took me to church, and her son was my best friend. So if I spent the night at their house on Saturday, we were going to church on Sunday. And so I heard the Sermon on the Mount. I recognized Jesus as Lord. And so I became a Christian then, but I didn't get discipled. There were many years that went by where I wasn't discipled. I had oases along the way, which was, I'm very thankful for those. That includes bouncing from Christian middle school to public high school, a Lutheran middle school, then a public school, then Catholic high school. So kind of going everywhere. The main reason I went to the Catholic high school was I started to play hockey as a junior in high school. A little bit before then. So I went to Catholic high school in my junior year. And the main reason was they had a hockey team. So my friend was going there, and they were starting a hockey team, and I was just starting to play ice hockey. And I was just starting it. And I was really lit. I was around 15 or so. And so that's a tough age to start playing hockey if you want to be good. And fortunately I was a skate guard and I worked at the rink. I thought skate guards were like the coolest thing. And so I had to work my way up to skate guard, which is a story in and of itself. But as a skate guard, I got a lot of ice time. So I got to practice skating a lot. And then I worked at the rink. So I got to play a lot of hockey, and I was at the rink like every single day practicing, trying to get better. And I ended up getting better over the next 2 years, my junior, senior year. And I went to Connecticut after that to play hockey. And I played there for 3 years. And I went to two schools in Connecticut. And then when I came back home, I went to a school called Broward Community College. It's now Broward College. And I went to FAU. Okay. And I played hockey for FAU for 1 year. And that was pretty tough. in the sense of because I hadn't been discipled, I was drifting a lot, being tossed and turned by every wind of doctrine. And so I had a lot of false views that were leading to difficulties too in my own worldview and my own challenges I faced. And anyway, so I did start, I was going to church now, just usually typically on Sundays. And one of my friends at church suggested Liberty to me. And I was like, well, if I want to learn about God, I can do that in Florida. And why would I move to Virginia? And so we actually had two guys on our team when I was in Connecticut from Virginia. And that made me even more scared to go to Virginia. And they might laugh about it now, but I've seen them since I've moved to Virginia. And so anyway, the a couple weeks go by and he's like, Ben, you know they have a hockey team at Liberty, right? And I'm like, dude, why wouldn't you have started with this? Like, I'm a hockey guy. That's one of the things that like I do a lot. And so after that, I went on online. They actually had just built a rink on campus in January of that year in 2006, and they were playing, so they had some photos on their website. So that summer I saw the pictures in the locker room, and I was like, I took called the coach. I sent him like my information. He told me how to apply. I got in, and then I went to Liberty, and that's what got me here.
All right.
And that's kind of my background to it. God used hockey. Just how he got me here.
Hey,
So
stranger things have happened.
yeah, oh no, of course. Well, you know, it's neat at Liberty. They have a lot of really neat facilities here. And some people might wonder, why do they have all this stuff? Like we have a snowplex. You can go skiing year round at Liberty.
Oh, that's
But they do
cool.
that to try to bring people in. This is the original idea, to bring people in so that they can give them the gospel or help disciple them. And so but while I was here, I'm just going through the halls with one of the hockey goalies, and he introduces me to the old hockey coach. And they're like, "Hey, Ben, this is Dr. Gary Habermas. Do you want to meet him and shake his hand?" I'm like, "Oh, that's nice. You're the old hockey coach. We're the new guys. Of course, we're good. Yeah, we're the best. You know, the guys playing are always better than everybody else. It's just how it goes. And if it's not, then your team's lacking in confidence, and that's not a good thing." So, I was like, that's pretty neat. Yeah, he gave me a book, some yellow book too. I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. Thank you. And he was nice, and we went our ways. And then I started asking questions about God, and I saw that people here actually thought about them and thought about them deeply and studied them deeply and weren't satisfied with superficial answers. So I felt comfortable asking more questions myself, because in Florida, people ask you really personal questions, even though they just met you. But those sorts of worldview, God questions, ethical questions, they were ones like that weren't talked about quite as much. And so I was growing up, I had questions about Christianity, but I didn't have a lot of people to talk that I felt comfortable talking to about those questions. And then other people's worldviews, I was like, oh, I don't, that's what you think. So I was just curious, but I don't know why would you think that? And so because I had my own questions, I was much more reluctant to share my faith or why I was a Christian or anything like that. But then at Liberty, I got to get introduced to some of these things, some podcasts, some debates, some lectures. And I was like, oh my goodness, this is awesome. So I ended up taking a class called Christian Evidences. And we read this book, The Case for the Resurrection by Dr. Lacona and Dr. Habermas. And I was like, oh, this is the former hockey coach. And so I sent him a couple of emails and I was like, hey, what about this or what about that? And he's basically, Paul was the answer for both of them. He's like, Paul's not in a position for any of those things. And I was like, oh, that's a good point. And that's all it was. So I just, Habermas also does a lot with dealing with doubt, aside from, you know, his 1,000 pages on the resurrection, of volume one that just came out. And, but that was a great example of factual doubt. Like I just had a factual question, there's no pain involved, and then the response, and then I moved on. So it was very helpful. And then, I wanted to be law enforcement and help people, but I didn't know how to help people, but I knew God could. So I was like, well, I better start studying this a little bit more if I'm going to help people. And so I ended up, my undergrad was in marketing, because if I was told if you get hurt as a law enforcement officer, you want to fall back. So I was like, okay, I'm going to do marketing. And then I did a Master Arts in Religious Studies because I was interested in other worldviews from South Florida. There's a bunch of different worldviews. What do they believe? Why is Christianity unique and distinct from them? And the resurrection was what I ended up doing my master's thesis on, because that is one of the big reasons. And then I still was able to continue an education after that, and got my PhD after that. So I did that in theology at Liberty as well. I started actually after my first year in the PhD program, Dr. Habermas's old research assistant retired. That's not the best way. He didn't retire, he just moved on.
I just moved
And
on,
so, yeah, I don't want to say he retired. He's teaching at Liberty. He's writing books like crazy. So he's definitely not retired. But he moved out of that position. And then Dr. Habermas was like, Ben, do you want to help me as my research assistant? And so that helped me get my PhD. So I was like, of course, yeah, that sounds great. Plus, I get to study the resurrection. What a great topic. And so we did that. And so I've been studying with him for over a decade. And that was before he started working on his big magnum opus, which, for those of you who aren't familiar with that, he's been working on a four-volume series on Jesus's resurrection. And each volume is almost 1,000 pages or so. So it's really big. It's like Acts commentary by Keener that Kevin and I were talking about, we've talked about before. And so volume one just came out in January. It's 1,054 pages just on historical method and the evidence for the resurrection. Volume two is coming out in October, I believe it is, and it's about 950 pages on alternative theories. So what are some alternative, did the disciples steal the body? Did they hallucinate? Things like that. So just 900 pages on that, just covering it, once.
No big deal.
And then the third volume will be a scholarly spectrum of views. And so that's really it highlights a number of different categories within resurrection research and where scholars are, with about 7,000 footnotes on those. And that's one of the ones where I had to help do a lot of work on that one too. The fourth one will be pastoral and practical implications for the resurrection. So, because it's not just an event that happened in the past, it has impact in the present as well. So he covers all those, and that's what we were working on. So we got to do research and publications throughout that, and so that's kind of my background.
Man, I know when we talked the other day about some other things that we're going to get to here in just a minute. Yeah, I think you had mentioned Habermas's magnum opus, but you hadn't gone into as much detail about it then as you did just now. Volume one sounds particularly interesting for some of the things that I've been up to, because as you mentioned, my book is on a book from my dissertation is on those what people in the guild call the criteria of authenticity. It's basically tools for how to do history, and there are a lot of people who study Jesus as a figure in history who say that those tools are outdated or that we need to find better tools because there's all these different views on what Jesus actually did in history. And if there's all these different views, then maybe the tools aren't that good. And Ben, like you mentioned, what I showed was that we use those tools whether we want to or not, because that's just how you have to treat historical documents of drawing these inferences and assessing like who said what about what and how close were they to the time that the events and anyway, Volume one of Habermas's work sounds particularly interesting for some of the stuff that I'm doing. So I'm glad to know about that.
Yeah, he covers historical method. He does a lot too with postmodernism, and just the philosophy of history itself, which is important. But yeah, I think, again, you just said it, and it gets me thinking about your work. Just because people take a hammer and don't use it for a nail doesn't mean a hammer is no longer a good, hammer for what it's intended to do. Just because someone takes it and maybe smashes out a window doesn't mean we should stop using hammers and we can't build houses anymore. Just anyway, as you can tell, I have an affinity for the criteria. Just to me, it's intuitive.
Well, and they're useful. And it's not just historians of Jesus. So this is another thing that I mentioned too, and have two of the five chapters of my book. Ben, you didn't know that I was going to interview you just to set up me talking about my own
That's
book. It's not just historians of Jesus that find these kinds of tools interesting. So here's an example. So just to kind of actually make it, real instead of just theoretical. Historians can believe that there is a higher probability that something happened in history when independent, multiple independent sources say that the thing happened. Now, that's not a slam dunk, right? It's not a slam dunk. But if multiple and independent sources say, yeah, thing X happened, or person X said thing Y, or talked about thing Y, that increases the probability that we're dealing with, historical fact. Especially, and we can grade that a little bit and nuance it a little bit too, especially if, person one over here is a fan of, person X, but person two over here is a foe or is ambivalent to person X. If both of these people agree that person X was known to do things like cast out demons or heal, perform miraculous healings or talk about the kingdom of God and the need for repentance and stuff like that, that also increases our probability that we're dealing with historical fact. Because when friends and when we have a common view to friend and foe alike, that is there's less probability that both parties are lying about what the person said or did or something like that. So that's one of the ways that we can that we as historians that's one of the ways that we as historians can assess kind of the probability of some of these things that we've talked about. So
Yeah, and
anyway.
it's just a it adds probability. We're not saying it's a calculator. You just plug all these equations in and
Exactly.
you get this out, but it adds probability. And I use everyday examples. In part, I didn't include this, but when I was getting my degree, I had a full-time job as an insurance adjuster. So I did property and cars, and so there's all sorts of different areas where that intertwines. And just to use an everyday example is if you see a car accident. And both drivers get out and say, it wasn't my fault. You're like, okay, so how do we start discerning? Someone here, isn't telling the truth or they're not being reliable. And if one of the person has a passenger in the car and that passenger happens to be their wife, and that wife is going, it was my husband's fault. Don't he ran the red light or he ran the stop sign. Well, that's embarrassing testimony. The wife's not going to want to admit that information typically, unless we have reason to believe she wouldn't. And
Sure.
so she's offering their embarrassing evidence. And then if you add, like you said, multiple attestation, if you've got another witness who was like, yeah, it looked like that one car with the two passengers, yeah, they ran that light. That's what I thought I saw. And now you have some corroboration. And well, seems likely he was at fault and he's not wanting to, admit it. And so those are all helpful things. And they happen every day.
Yeah.
Everything happened today. They can same thing we use today use to know the distant past.
Yep. Last comment on that too, and then we'll get into some of the other things that I wanted to ask you about. The historians of Jesus who still favored those particular methods, those particular tools, none of them use those tools with 100% certainty that they're going to give us a slam dunk on the kinds of things that they are assessing, for probability or degrees of probability or even plausibility or things like that. None of them are arguing that those things are slam dunk. Now, Ben and I go into some detail about this because there's a whole other branch of historians of Jesus who I think might, Ben, I think that their perspective it might kind of be rising to sort of a new consensus in historical Jesus studies. But there's a whole group of historians of Jesus who are basically arguing that we can throw out these tools and use other things, and we don't have time to go into what those other things are. And I what I argued in my book is, well, no, you can't. You just can't do that. And I've demonstrated that you can't do that because in your own book, when you say you can do that, you end up using them anyway. You just don't know
Oh,
that. It's just
yeah,
not
you're digging
obvious.
in. It's a rose by any other smell, It's a rose by any other name. Sorry.
Ben, how'd you get interested in apologetics in the first place? And you mentioned you kind of some questions about worldview, but and like what do we've used this term apologetics. What exactly does that even mean? Maybe let's start with that. What is apologetics, and how did you kind of find yourself interested in all that?
Yes, so I take apologetics is typically taken out of the 1 Peter 3:15 verse where it says, "Always be prepared to give a reason for the hope that you have within you." And the word reason there is apologia, the Greek word, and it just means to give a defense, a word back, a response. Socrates gave a famous apologia in Greece, and so there's nothing distinctively Christian about it. I could give an apologia for certain football teams.
For those not watching but just listening, Ben takes a slow, knowing drink out of his Auburn tumbler
That's
after we had
correct.
just talked briefly about this beautiful tri-star flag that I have here on my desk.
Yeah, so we do apologetics for all sorts of different things. Anytime you're given a reason for something, you're doing apologetics. Now that's the very broad understanding there. When it comes to the Christian worldview, we and when I say we, I'm talking about core apologetics as well. We take like a holistic approach to it. It's not just giving an answer back. That's part of it. But if we're going to give an answer back or a reason for the hope that we have within us, well, we have to. It's harder to share that hope that we have within us if we're not really sure why we have that hope in the first place, or if we're not understanding that hope. It can be more difficult, and that's part of my background. But also, too, is when we get confronted with other worldviews, we want to be prepared to share with them how are we distinct, how are we different, why do we think what we think. And so apologetics in a somewhat tighter sense, it's not being prepared for every objection. It's not trying to understand, thank goodness too, by the way. But it's having a reason for the hope that we have. So what is it that has convinced us? We don't to use just a math example, once we see that 2 + 2 = 4, we see that we've got good evidence for that. We don't have to go, okay, why is 2 + 2 = 5 bad? Why is 2 + 2 = 6 bad? We don't have to go through every objection. Here's what we have seen. Here's why we have the hope that we have. However, people should also be asking us, our lives should be lived out in such a way that people ask us, why are you so hopeful? Why is your life filled with love, joy, peace, patience, gentleness, kindness, goodness, self-control, things like that? So there's a head part, there's a heart part, and there's a hand part. Like our activity should be reflecting it as well. So it's a very holistic approach. And the apologetics, having those reasons for the hope that we have, they can also be beneficial to us in times of our own. This is for discipleship building. So I kind of alluded to an evangelistic component to it because you're more prepared to share your hope, or you're more confident in sharing your hope. There's this song, a gentleman from Corporate Chaplains of America shared this song with me. Now, I don't know if you knew this existed. I just found out about it. But I guess in the 90s, there was Christian ska music. And
Oh yeah,
that's the
I
thing.
remember that.
Yeah. Well, in one of the songs,
The Supertones, the OC Supertones.
Supertones. Right. Wow. Yeah. That's a little different from the bands, the punk bands that I would listen to, but I was
Man, I
just, I
haven't thought
couldn't
about
believe
them in like 20 years.
it. Yeah. The chaplain, we were talking, and he brought up this band. He's like, "Yeah, they got this song. How are you gonna stand if you don't understand?" And I was just like, "That's gonna be our theme song." You know, we're kind of just joking around and stuff like that. And so, but yeah, so that's the evangelism component. But there's the discipleship component too. When you think of verses like Romans 12:1 and 2, we want to have our minds transformed. In Philippians 4, we want to dwell on that which is good and holy and pure. We and throughout scripture, it's meditating on God's word. So we can meditate on those things that give us hope so that when we're in those moments of temptation, trial, or tribulation, or whatever the case may be, we can recall and dwell upon those things. So there's a discipleship component there as well that can even motivate us to good works. And I'll just use one example, and before I think that it kind of just addresses how we understand apologetics and what is apologetics. And why I got involved and why I got interested in it. But I used to be someone who would Ecclesiastes was kind of, I would hear quotes from there, you know, everything is vain, vanity of vanities. I was like, yeah, it's tough. And I'm from South Florida, and I would see people chasing the pursuits of the typical pursuits of South Florida, and I would see
Yeah.
that they were vain. There'd be a lot of people that would seek them, and then they'd be left empty afterwards. I'm like, oh, I kind of struggled with that. And then as I started studying the resurrection, and I remember one day I was listening to N.T. Wright, and he goes, you guys read at the end of chapter 15 of 1 Corinthians, the resurrection chapter, the very last verse, 58, Paul says, believers, just kick your feet up, wait and relax until Jesus returns as judge, and everything will be good. It's like, no, that's not what he says. That's not what he says at all. He says, be steadfast in your good works, for they're not in vain. So I was like, oh, that what like an encouraging and motivating verse to remind myself. So anyway, it does have that kind of it's a dual-edged sword of evangelism and discipleship.
Yeah, that's what I wasn't able to verbalize it at that point in my life when I needed to listen to certain apologists. I've done an episode on this. I think this might have been one of my first like dozen or so episodes in the 3 years that I've been podcasting now. It was actually on all of the allegations that came out about Ravi Zacharias. And so prior to those, I listened to him a lot, especially when I was in college. Well, I was in college from 2004 to 2008, and as we were talking earlier, that was kind of in the heyday or in the ascendancy of this group of prominent atheist, scientists and authors and thinkers known as the New Atheist. For those who are kind enough to listen to the podcast, may refer to my episode with Justin Brierley, where he talks about his book, The Surprising Rebirth of God, Rebirth of Belief in God, Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God. And these guys like Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins and Daniel Dennett and the late Christopher Hitchens, that these guys in the early 21st century, the first decade and a half, maybe, they were making a very prominent case for atheism. And I never remember encountering anybody who threw that kind of stuff back at me, but I remember being aware of those arguments and thinking, man, if somebody did ask me about that, I don't know what I would say. And so I listened to Ravi Zacharias quite a bit in my free time. I even bought it. I'm looking at a bookshelf over here on the other side of my office. The book entitled The Dawkins Delusion by Alistair McGrath. And he it was kind of a point by point response, apologia, like I said, point by point response or refutation to Dawkins' book, The God Delusion. And that was really comforting. And it also, like you said, it addressed intellectual questions that I had. But the way the Bible presents it, especially the way that Paul presents it, in his letters, is that the intellectual questions or concerns that you might have, the belief, the doctrinal belief that you might have, ought to lead to right living. It ought to lead to ethics. I mean, his whole argument there in Colossians, I mentioned Colossians because I did a series of lectures on those a few months ago at my alma mater. Colossians is about understanding the supremacy of Jesus. And when you understand that properly, then you will behave in certain ways. And so Ben, even though I wasn't able to verbalize it as succinctly as you just did back when I was an undergraduate, that is definitely what I was looking for. And things like, apologetics, and particularly the group that you're with now, those kinds of groups can really help people answer these kinds of questions and give them something really meaningful to work with. In your work in apologetics, is there like one or two questions that tend to show up more than others, or are there certain topics that people care more about? And how would you kind of help people answer those or find answers to those?
Let me answer your question, then I want to add to what you were just saying.
Sure thing. Oh, yeah.
So one of the courses I was teaching at Colorado Christian University was advanced objections to Christianity. And at the start of each class, we would do a survey, and they would talk to, I wanted to make sure they talked to everybody. So, like, because we didn't want to get just what Christians think unbelievers think, but what do actually unbelievers think about Christians? What do Christians think unbelievers think about Christians? What's a pastor think of Christians? So they'd interview a number of people. And the consistent theme we would see is there's usually be a top three, and one of them was typically related. The problem of evil was typically one, though that has seemingly started to phase out a little bit
Okay.
as being a primary issue.
Let's return to that, 'cause
Yeah, I
that
think I see that
surprises
on
me.
I see that on a couple levels too.
Okay.
Secondly, was Christian hypocrisy. And so when you were mentioning hearing those the new atheists, I kind of heard stuff like that before they kind of like got prominent. But for me it was Ned Flanders. I was kind of
Okay.
oh man, Ned Flanders is like the symptomatic, that's like the stereotypical Christian. That's how they were portrayed. And so I was like, that how do I like be a solid Christian who's not this Simpsons stereotype
Yeah,
on
for
the
those not
TV?
familiar, that is a character from The Simpsons. Is he the like the minister in the town or something?
No, he's the neighbor who's he's very nice, but they make him too nice, and they make him over, it's just way over the top, and then they make Christians look silly, to put it mildly.
Yeah.
Not as bad as the new atheists did it.
Sure.
They certainly took it to a new level, but when I was growing up too, I'd also see pastors and guys at churches going to jail, just like we see today, for doing
Yeah.
things they shouldn't have been doing. So then you see culture rightly saying that's wrong. And then, but they would then move to that's wrong, therefore Christianity's bad. And it's like, well, that step's not right. Actually, you're saying they're wrong because they're hypocrites, because they're not doing what Jesus said. So you're agreeing with what Jesus said in order to say what they did was wrong and that they're hypocrites. But that doesn't mean we should get rid of Christianity. So I was trying to wrestle with how do I respond and deal with that? Just personally, my own, how do I resolve that myself? And then, but we do see that question still raised. It's very, I think it's a one easy, relatively easy to address as far as intellectually. The third one is how do we know the New Testament or the Bible is reliable, or that Jesus rose from the dead? And sometimes they'd be kind of like intertwined as
Those honestly are
category
kind of
question.
intertwined, yeah.
Yeah. What's interesting is I just, so one of the things that we're trying to do at Core Apologetics is we want to help discipleship in all disciplines. So this is a segue for this kind of type of comment. There are very few. I don't know of any. I'll just say that. I don't know of any organizations that are trying to help bring an apologetic thread into businesses or business or Christian business companies, like any organizations that try to help Christian businessmen. So we don't want to try to be a Christian business consulting company or anything like that, but we want to bring an apologetic thread to those guys so that they can go and be excellent businessmen and do so well and do so confidently and competently. And what's interesting about that is within the past couple of years, maybe 2021 or so, it might be 22, but it said pastors will speak to 8.8 nominal Christians or non-believers. Business owners will speak to 118 million. So they are encountering these discussions a lot more often. So it just seems obvious or clear to me, like, let's equip them. They're going to be the ones in the discussions. They need to be the ones equipped because they're on the front lines. And so I had a businessman reach out to me the other day, and I was like, well, I don't want to assume I know you're, because there's different areas of the country and the world have different objections they're wrestling with. And so I was like, I don't want to assume, but like, what are the three you're running into, or the top three if you had to pick? And the three he named were the ones we were discussing, except Christian exclusivity was another he had
Oh, I
before.
see. Yeah.
So yeah, we do kind of see those threads, those three threads. But you did want to mention something, I think, on the problem of evil.
Yeah, that surprises me. I wonder, why do you think the problem of evil is kind of falling in importance for people who are wrestling with the kinds of issues that apologetics can address. Because I was unaware of that, so I'm genuinely interested in what you have to say.
Yeah, I think, and I'm just speaking on the popular level. On the academic side of things, I'm not quite sure where it stands. I know the logical problem, that's been shown to be a problem. Not for the it's shown. Sorry, let me make sure I get that right. It's been shown not to be a problem for theists since Planigon Rho. But I think what a lot of people have come to realize, and this goes hand in hand with what Justin Brierley, I think, is finding with the people he's talking with in his book, is if there is, and this is an old Ravi line too, actually, if I recall correctly, if there's such a thing as evil, there's such a thing as good. And if there's such a thing as evil and good, then there's a way to distinguish or a law that helps us differentiate between the two. And if there's a law, then there's a moral lawgiver. And so we can't escape this feeling of that's evil when we're seeing it or when we encounter it. And so then the question is, well, how do I even know that's evil and what is good? And people are starting to recognize, well, we don't want to say a culture or my tribe or whatever, relativistic answer we can give, because we understand, wow, the Nazis could make a similar claim that they thought what they were doing was good. And that doesn't sit right with a lot of us. And so I think you have people like Ayaan Hirsi, who she was a Muslim, then she became an atheist, and then recently she became a Christian, or she says she became a Christian because she saw that the evil that was going on, the cultural decline that was going on, is part and parcel because of this abandonment of Christianity, and it's Christianity that can bring that light into the world. And so that's what we need. And I think that's really important. Just seeing that this is what we need. And when we talk about the new atheists, what do their disciples look like? What do the people that they've mentored, what do they look like? What are the fruits? We're told to look at people's fruits. What are the fruits of those who have followed them? And what are the results? What are the things we're getting? And the same thing, we want to ask that, believers as well. What are some of the fruits of those things? And I think when you look at guys like, so you see someone like Ayaan Hirsi, you see someone like Tom Holland, not Spider-Man, but the historian,
The historian,
difference there. When he looks back at ancient Rome and says, I used to think that I was Roman, but I look at that world and I am an alien to that world. I am very much a Christian because of his worldviews and values. And then there's
Who
just
is not a
a number of
professing Christian,
right, not a
but in
professor.
terms of worldview and values, I think a guy like Douglas Murray, another British cultural commentator, Douglas Murray would say something similar, and Justin Perlin did end up talking about Douglas as well.
I think it was Douglas Murray who, when Jordan Peterson and Sam Harris were having their dialogues, Douglas Murray recognized this too. He's like, if we're doing so good as atheists, why do we send our kids to Christian schools to learn morality? And you just put it out there, and you're like, it's a good question. Like, I mean, they're good questions. We want to be asking those questions. And it's, we can say things, we can believe all sorts of things, but what are some of the evidences that can sustain us when our emotions are going, crazy? How do we sustain them, and how do we support those things that are goods? Because we've seen what those goods look like. And so anyway, that's probably a good place to, before we go too far afield, that's
So
a good podcast in and of itself.
Core is able to help, just people who are interested in apologetics. But kind of the target audience that you envision is people who are more frequently interacting with either non-believers or just laypersons. And y'all are equipping these business people and other folks to be able to speak cogently, to give a reason for the hope that they have, right? To go back to 1 Peter 3. That's what y'all are doing. What are some ways that y'all do that? You offer classes and like do you have conferences, things like that?
Yeah, so we are although we are very new in the sense we relaunched in October, November of last year, so we're very new. I've been working with Dr. Habermas for about a decade. My colleague, and he's the one who originally founded Core Apologetics, and the reason for that is as Habermas started working on his magnum opus, he couldn't talk to as many doubters as he was normally talking to because he would never get to his book. And so he asked, one day, "Hey, who's someone that could be happy to take some of my doubters so that they can talk to you?" And Ron was like, "I'll do it." That was a whole purpose. He went to Liberty's PhD program just because Habermas was there, and he wanted to study doubt because that's just due to his background. He's like, "I want to know how to help people with doubt." So Habermas started sending him all his doubters. And since 2016, he's talked to about 1,300 or 1,400 doubters. So he's talked to a ton of people, and he's still doing it. And I actually sat on his district. I was on his dissertation committee, and we were talking, and we both have some insurance background, so we talk about that, and we talk about emotional doubt and apologetics. And he knew I was the my position at the insurance company seemed to be coming towards its end. The season was ending. I'd been with them 14 years. So he Ron goes, "Well, Ben, what if we partnered together and we did core apologetics as something more than just talking with doubters?" So there's a strong emphasis for helping doubters, but now we've really just expanded it because I bring the some elements of resurrection apologetics and things like that. But what we're trying to do is take apologetics, carry on Habermas's work for building up disciples and helping to minister to doubters. And so that looks like different things in the church, that looks like different things in discipline. So because we want to make disciples of all disciplines too, like we want people who are out in the world, whether it's law enforcement, whether it's lawyers, whether it's businessmen, whether it's medical field, the arts. We want to help that Christian foundation to go and do whatever talents and gifts that God has given them to excel at them exceedingly, like to just make it excellent and as a worthy offering to the Lord, like just excellence all around. So we do help churches and we help organizations and we help individuals. So we do different things. We've got a couple different events that we can do on our website. We have classes. And so as someone who's been teaching online and have been in academia, one of my fears is that, especially for academics, is like we get a degree, so what? So we can go to another school and teach people how to get a degree so that they can go to a school, teach people how to get a degree. And it's like that does not seem very fruitful. So how do we get those guys getting those degrees to get into the disciplines? Like, hey, I know you're not an engineer, but you got a good New Testament degree, and these guys could use some, like, bring that to them, help them. And what does that look like? So that's part of it. Another is this: there appears to be a specialization of the sacred, where only guys in the ivory towers, so to speak, get to talk. You shouldn't have to go get a master's degree to get a disciple. You shouldn't have to get a PhD to become a disciple. You should be able to get those things at your church. But if for there's reasons why the church may be talking about other subjects or doing other things, so we want to help supplement in those ways. And that's why we're core apologetics, because we're just focusing on the core beliefs. So for example, we have four classes that we do. And I mentioned I teach online, and I felt like a moderator online, like, "You guys go through the classes. I check off if you've done the work, if you've done, but I don't actually talk to you. I don't actually talk to them aside from an email or something." So, and I found too, there was a lot of people in the classes who were just trying to grow in their faith and do better, but they had to go get a master's to do it. And so they're like, "Oh, this is actually a lot of work. It's more than I thought. I just want to know the Lord better. I don't necessarily need an MA or whatever." And so I was like, "Well, I was talking to Ron, like, what if we offer these classes where you could come, you actually talk to a person? So we teach the class live. There's a live professor there, someone with a degree teaching these classes. They might ask you questions. So as the student, you're getting like asked the question and prepared to give an answer back. And then you can also ask the teacher questions. So there's actual feedback and fellowship going on. So that's really good. There's still some work. There's not, the work is you do required reading. So like, for example, our class on Jesus's resurrection is getting ready to end. We're aiming to end it right before Easter, so all the people can go to their communities. And if they want to do a small group on Jesus's resurrection, now they can do that. They're equipped. They're helped to do that. And we've gone through the book, The Case for the Resurrection. So, I think the most reading they did in a week was like 20 pages. So it's manageable for families, people with jobs, and you're serving at your church. How do we help equip them? So we also have a class on dealing with doubt, biblical worldview, and then New Testament reliability, which is an area which I just I'm trying to think of a diplomatic way to put it, but it's a topic I enjoy.
That was the kind of stuff that, like, reliability of the New Testament, that I always found myself very drawn towards, that in biblical languages. And I think part of it was because I was a history major in undergrad, so I was not a Bible or religion major. I was a history major. And then, after drifting away from that and getting my Master's of Divinity bit on into a PhD in Biblical Studies, I ended up writing my dissertation on, well, how to do history as a historian of Jesus. And it was those kinds of things. It was those kinds of questions about, can the resurrection really stand up to scrutiny? Those were the kinds of questions that I found myself having. And I'm very grateful for, a lot of the folks that I've read. We've mentioned both Mike Lekkonen here. Mike Lekkonen was on my dissertation committee. Saw him in San Antonio back in November at Society of Biblical Literature Conference. It was great chatting with him. And then we were in the same session, and we ducked out at the same time. And then he was like, "Oh, hey, let me catch Bill over here." And it was William Lane Craig, another very, very well-known scholar, who runs in similar circles. But it was so neat to get to see these guys, that their work has been so valuable for me. And as they've passed on their work to me, I pass that on to, businessmen and women and teachers and, other people who are in my church. And so this discipleship setting that I find myself in at church has benefited incredibly from kind of work that these guys are doing, the kind of work that y'all are doing. And it's just been so helpful to
Let me add a little
ask
thing
those,
to
answer
that.
those kinds of questions. Yeah, go ahead.
Let me add a little, just a little, another angle to that. Because one of the things we're trying to do is get the seminary out of the seminary into the churches.
Yeah.
And one of the things we want to do is do these types of master classes where maybe you've got a bunch of church leaders or even pastors who they're not going to be able to go back to school, or they can't go to school, or whatever the case is. But they want to be able to study with some of these experts. Like, so if you want to study with Habermas right now, you've got to enroll in the PhD program. You've got to come up here for the week-long class and take all these other classes on top of that. So what we want to do, this is one of our goals, aside from those classes, because in the classes we'd like to have 10,000 people go through them, go through those courses in the next 3 to 5 years. That's one of our goals. But we also want to have these classes where you have Habermas teaching for 2 full days on the resurrection, and it's open to the leaders of the church, open to the public, really. And so that way, but it's going to be a smaller setting. It's not going to be like an event or a seminar where there's or a conference, I mean, where there's thousands of people. It's going to be limited, so you can actually have some interaction and fellowship. As you can tell, it's kind of a thing. We want to build that when we can. And so if you get a chance, if you have a chance to go study for 2 days with Craig, I'll be happy to go. I can go do that. And so we want to be able to do that. So those are some of the long-term plans we have that we'd like to do something with guys like Lekkonen. I think Turek is great too, just on how he engages people. So there's a number of different people, and if they're an expert in their field and you don't want to go study for 50 years, but you want to go learn about the resurrection, why not come here for, 2 days or a day and get that? So those are some of the other things we'd like to do longer term.
Yeah, man, it sounds great. And I can see, just being in the context that I'm in, I can see a lot of value in that. There are a lot of ministers out there who do want additional training, but you're right. They either don't have time to get a whole MA or MDiv. Sorry, that's Insider language for those who are listening, a whole Masters of Arts in either Old Testament, New Testament, or Masters of Divinity, something like that. They don't have time to do all of that. But they still could really benefit from,
Yes, of
some
course.
direct interaction with these folks. So, Ben, our time is kind of winding down a little bit here. Where can we follow your work and talk to us about some of the other things that you have that are available that folks might be interested in?
Yes. So we have a website, coreapologetics.com, and so that's one area you can find us. I do need to mention, because we are a new ministry, like I said, we've just started. We have started, just recently launched, it's called the Core Project. And so this is one of the ways in which, although we're a new ministry and we're trying to raise funds, we understand there's a body of Christ and there's different parts of the body that support one another. So one of the things we're trying to do is to synchronize or harmonize those who are gifted in giving with our gifts that we bring. Since we're new, we're kind of limited. We have these few classes that we can give. But what we want to do is we're looking for 100 core project partners to partner with us to help support our ministry. And then with that, depending on how they come in, we have classes that they can either take or they can sponsor or scholarship somebody. So for example, we have some churches that have partnered with us because they believe in our mission and our vision. And so now they have some of their church members attending this resurrection class. So they can give those to their members or to their friends or to their family. We had someone do that with their brother in this class as
Very
well.
cool.
So it's a good way that allows us to use the gifts God's given us and bring them together with the gifts that other people have. So the core project is something we're working on and trying to build that up because we'd like this ministry to continue. And then, in addition to that, one of the other things is I'll have a book coming out in July called 13 Arguments. It's actually called, sorry, Trustworthy: 13 Arguments for the Reliability of the New Testament. And it's designed for those guys who are going to Liberty just because they have a hockey team. So
That's
that
great.
would be me as an undergrad.
Yeah.
I should note, like, I didn't realize Paul wrote half the New Testament when I came to Liberty. So those are like, when you start seeing those things, you're like, oh man, and he's writing Romans and he's writing Corinthians. I need to listen up. So it's a really a system systematizing of what a lot of New Testament scholars, I think, are familiar with, but because they're so busy thinking at that black belt level that they forget what the white belts think about. And I still remember that feeling quite well. Some would say I'm still, because I'm there. This book is geared for them. Again, it's geared for those busy guys who are not interested in reading. Like, well, I Habermas and I, for example, understand not everyone's going to pick up his 1,000 pages on the resurrection. That's okay. The case for the resurrection is out there. It's much shorter. It's great for most people. So that's what this book is aimed at. It's about 150 pages, maybe 10 pages a chapter. And of course, for hockey guys, I say that just joking,
For
but
hockey guys, yeah.
it's got pictures. It's got some charts and graphs in there.
That's how you're gonna advertise it. Hey, for you
Yeah.
hockey guys out there.
Some hockey guys are going to start thumping me soon for talking like that.
Yeah, you're going to get checked into the wall if you're not
Yeah,
careful.
yeah. So, and then we do have Core Apologetics on like Twitter and LinkedIn
Great.
and some of the other social media. I'm only on LinkedIn. It's the only one that I think is actually, I think it's good for us to be there because there's not a lot of apologetics on LinkedIn. And there's a lot of people doing work on those other sites. So in any event, that's where we're at, coreapologetics.com, and then just regular old social media.
Yeah, all right. Ben, really appreciate your time today, sir. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
Take care.